Hello everyone, welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, RusJournal.org. Today is September 11th, 2019. I say the same thing every year. Of course, I was the first person to write a revisionist article in the Spotlight. Or I don't even remember what the AFP was around. I don't remember exactly right. And the argument was that they said that Osama bin Laden did this. I remember I was in D.C. at the time, 15 minutes after the first plane hit. They said it was Osama bin Laden. How can they possibly know this? First of all, he was very, very sick in Pakistan with renal failure. And of course, after the USS Cole incident, all of his accounts were frozen. He was being watched like a hawk after that, which killed a few American sailors. It was laughable. But if you remember at the time, no one else was floated as a possible culprit. I watched everything, I read everything at the time, very distinctly remember that they were absolutely certain it was him. And I was a tad suspicious. And every terror group in the world claimed responsibility for it, with the exception of his. But when your accounts are frozen, when you're being watched very, very closely, not to mention when you're very ill, as he was, and he died that December, according to the New York Times, you can't lead any major plans. But when you come across any information like this, no matter how simply put, the American citizen has two choices. Either short circuit their cognition, their rational process with name calling or some virtue signaling. And the other choice is to bring your entire world into question, because that's what would happen if you begin to realize the implications, the fact that Osama bin Laden had nothing to do with this, that this was a setup to get the U.S. involved in the Middle East and Central Asia permanently. The entire thing was so incongruous, as if the poverty-stricken Taliban in Afghanistan could have anything to do with this. And Saddam Hussein, who normally was at war with them, I mean, it was so laughable. I mean, it just depended on the total ignorance of the American population. And beyond that, people who knew better didn't say a word. I had known of Osama bin Laden prior to 9/11. Not just from the Cole attack, but one of the first things I said to John Tiffany, who was with me at the time, is that this man has been watched, they took responsibility for that. And so there's no question this man is under very, very tight surveillance, and anyone even remotely associated with him. All of his accounts were frozen, and they were mostly in dollars, of course. And it's impossible that it was him. I remember as a kid, my eighth grade field trip was to the Trade Towers. I was only just an hour away in New Jersey. I distinctly remember the discussion that the city of New York demanded that this building be absolutely invincible, impervious. That it had to take not just one jumbo jet, but multiple. The alternative being, not only would it slaughter a huge number of people in Midtown Manhattan, but kill some of the richest and most powerful people in the world. This has been reinforced and reinforced and reinforced It's not ordinary steel. It's a coated, very highly purified variation, which is very, very expensive. And the builders complained about it. So it has a much, much higher melting temperature. Not that that would have any relevance anyway. You know, a jumbo jet is substantial, but anyone who hasn't seen the Trade Towers up close, this is a massive building. You know, that would create damage and kill people, but it sure the heck wouldn't bring it down. But maybe a couple of artillery shells worth of damage. It's a ridiculous theory, but the alternative is too great for most people to fathom, because it would mean their entire world, all their loyalties, everything they think, everything they believe, is now open to question. So I get that out of the way. Every year, the stupid ritualistic hand-wringing over that event, which led to the deaths of millions of people in Central Asia and the Middle East, thousands and thousands of American soldiers and mercenaries, and now tens of trillions of dollars. Every financial problem in the U.S. could have been solved easily had those wars not taken place. Well, maybe it's not too far removed that I want to talk about the Khmer Rouge today. I've always been fascinated by them because, of course, you know, I deal mostly with the history of political ideology. It's been my thing for many, many years in a Russian context, but in general. And the Communist Party of Cambodia, or Kampuchea, as they said, that name irritates me, so I never use it, was very eccentric. Now, of course, there were Maoists. There were followers of Mao Zedong, and they were highly dependent on the Chinese Communist Party for materiel and men. And people don't realize, even Vietnam, even though the Vietnamese became the big enemy, in the early years, the Vietnamese Communist Party was completely was manning much of their, you know, the so-called Republic of Cambodia, which I'll get to in a minute, under General Lan Nol. His men were defeated not by the Khmer Rouge, but by Vietnamese regulars and irregulars, which is something that hasn't made it into any history book, that at least not in English. You know, there's when you hear about a genocide or mass murder of any government, of course, you should be skeptical. These claims are being made all the time, usually against governments that the speaker doesn't like. And most of the time, it's not true. Or certainly not as bad as the speaker would like you to think it is. Communists are different, especially in the Asian variety coming from Mao Zedong, because violence and the cleansing of society and this revolutionary cataclysm is part of the ideology. This is not the case in National Socialism. This is not the case in Nationalism. This is not the case in in liberalism. It's not the case in Marxism alone has violence as an actual philosophical concept. But even Islam, I mean, it's integral to Islam, but it's not a pillar of the ideology like it is for communism. Lenin, Stalin, Trotsky, Mao, Pol Pot, Ho Chi Minh, this is all one and the same ideology. The notion of a violent cleansing of society is a concept that makes the whole system go. It's not an anomaly. It's not something they have to do because, you know, they have an obstacle that they have to overcome. It's not a necessary evil, not something, no, it's actually a part of their philosophical approach. And no one brought that concept to a fever pitch like Mao and his students in Cambodia. Besides that fact, Marxism is strictly materialist, which means that they believe all phenomena, actually everything that exists, is matter, has material foundation. So there can't be any freedom. By definition, there can't be any freedom. There can't be any soul. There can't be any mind. Everything, therefore, is reducible to basic cause and effect. So then why would killing someone be a problem? Why would it be a moral issue, especially if you think you're doing this for the greater good? If man is just a hunk of flesh and nerve endings, who cares if he's killed? I suppose the only argument they could make would be on utilitarian grounds. You know, it hurts, or people might be sad, or something like that. But there's nothing intrinsic to killing that's a problem to a materialist. This is one of the reasons that violence is such an integral part of the ideology. It really doesn't matter. The American left throughout, from 1920, really to today, but certainly until the late 80s, supported all of these regimes. Noam Chomsky made an absolute fool of himself, supporting Pol Pot and the Cambodian so-called Democratic Kampuchean Revolution. And partially they don't want to punch left, but partially because this is something that they accept. Once Pol Pot became indefensible, as the years went on, they needed to engage in damage control. And one of the things I want to argue here is that anytime you come across, really almost every history book, every mainstream work on the Khmer Rouge in the 70s in Cambodia, they make the claim that the U.S. had something to do with them coming to power. I mean, it's a laughable idea. There's several articles on the subject. There's one comment from Henry Kissinger where he speculates that maybe supporting a pro-Chinese movement in Cambodia could control Soviet expansionism via Vietnam. But what this comes down to is damage control. They don't want to be responsible. There's book after book now that's claiming that Pol Pot was influenced by Khmer nationalism, racism, and some kind of delusional vision of ancient glory and the rebuilding of the ancient empire. This is some kind of, you know, almost a conservative imperium, which of course is absolute nonsense. There's a whole theory that, you know, he essentially was taking Buddhist ideology and turning it towards communist ends. And the arguments for that, as I'll mention here in a minute, is very specious. All this comes down to is they're trying to avoid taking responsibility for supporting these people. They want to put the blame on something else. And they also want to make believe that this has nothing to do with Marxism, because they will never abandon the ideology. Now, Pol Pot's real name was Salah Sarr, an intellectual educated in France. As always, communists are usually of the upper classes. And you had something eccentric in Cambodia. Norodom Sihanouk was the reigning monarch, prince, who wanted more than anything else to be popular. It's one of the rare cases of a monarch supporting a communist movement. You had it in Laos too for a short period of time. Sihanouk tried to please everybody. His ideology was all over the place. He took many trips to Peking, talking to Mao. He would lean to the U.S. and he'd lean to the communists. And he actually was involved in the building of the Ho Chi Minh Trail. He condemned any attempt to root out Marxists or Maoists in Cambodian society. And he was overthrown by General Lan Nol. He's one of these guys that gets left out of most discussions. He's called, you know, corrupt and evil and fascist, and then they move on. Very little is said about him. Um, The communist movement in Cambodia was invited in and supported by the prince. Khmer Rouge received respectability because Prince Sihanouk gave them recognition. Now, it's also true that Leninist and Maoist movements always lied about their agenda. Now, leftists have been doing that, you know, since the French Revolution, since the British Revolution. The real agenda is for the initiates. But Sihanouk knew better. But more than any other group, the Khmer Rouge had a very, very secretive nature. And it's easy to fool people. It's easy for someone to support this, what appeared to be a populist and nationalist group, with an ideology that was known only to a few. And Pol Pot even said, well, the common citizen, the peasant doesn't really know anything about Leninism, but he does know something about Buddhism. So maybe, you know, some of our local people can couch it in those terms. They don't believe in any of it. They rooted it out. Royalism was an above board ideology, and it was very, very popular. Sihanouk did damage to the royal house. Lan Nol, who ruled until the Khmer Rouge took over, and he ruled the what we call the Khmer Republic from 1970 to 1975. It's common that Sihanouk and people like that would claim to be non-aligned and neutral while openly supporting the communist left. The infrastructure of Marxism in Cambodia, whether it be pro-Vietnamese or pro-Chinese, was laid out because the prince, who was popular, permitted it to happen, gave it his seal of approval. I don't believe it was done in ignorance. General Ngo overthrew him in 1970. And he did it for a few reasons. He did it because he began to realize that as the communists began to infiltrate Cambodian society, remember, 1970, he knew exactly what had happened in China. He knew that these people were going to slaughter huge numbers of Cambodians. So pretty much anything to keep them from taking power was justified, given the sheer rivers of blood that Mao had spilled and was going to be done in Cambodia. It's exactly what happened in Cambodia. It also meant that the Vietnamese were infiltrating Cambodian society. There was the infrastructure of the communist movement that came from Vietnam, especially early on. And the prince permitted this to happen. The reason that the U.S. began bombing Cambodia was because the prince had permitted, in the 60s, the Viet Cong and even North Vietnamese regulars to build the supply trail, so-called Ho Chi Minh Trail. The U.S. had every right to destroy this. And the fault lies not with the U.S., but with the North Vietnamese and with the prince. General Ngo eventually said that we can't have this anymore. The bombing was extremely destructive. And it's the fault of this very intense, what really amounted to a Vietnamese invasion of the country. So in 1970, he took over. The bombing campaign the U.S. engaged in, not to mention the Civil War itself, not to mention the attacks that the Vietnamese engaged in against anti-communist forces in Cambodia, created chaos in Cambodian society. This is a central key element in understanding what happened. Whenever the traditional kinship groups are broken, whenever the extended family is broken, whenever the peasant commune is broken, whenever religious ties, the old traditional patterns of land holding, which in Cambodia was actually very equalitarian, once those are disrupted, because during wartime, small landholders are insecure and they run to the strong. So it leads to concentration of power. Um, once these traditional patterns of landholding and the economy is broken down, then public morality collapses. Now all you have left is the state. Unfortunately, La Nol, he ruled until 1975, but he had a minor stroke in 1971. But he had a small problem, and that is he was being supplied by the United States. The U.S. pulled out of Vietnam, as we all know, in 1973, and in the process pulled out of any support they had for La Nol's government the same year. The man is fighting a nasty civil war against two factions of a very lavishly supplied communist movement, one pro-Chinese, one pro-Vietnamese, and now he has no money or ammunition to do it. The economy had collapsed. Inflation was spiraling. And between 1973 and 1975, the Khmer Republic collapsed, and he fled to California, where he died several decades later. General La Nol was a royalist, first and foremost. When he overthrew Prince Sihanouk, he went to his mother, Cosimac, and begged her forgiveness. He didn't want to do this. Sihanouk had a very bizarre reputation. He was popular. The royal line was popular. The old medieval traditions were popular, like they always are. But when you have this level of disruption and civil war and bombing and confusion and foreign armies and Soviet assistance and Chinese assistance and Vietnamese assistance and the U.S., you know, that chaos leads to the total breakdown of morals and any real traditional sense of politics. La Nol had a sense of unifying all the Khmers of Southeast Asia. There were some living in near the Mekong Delta, some in Thailand. He was socially conservative. He was firmly royalist, with some strong socialist and statist elements, which was certainly significant for a small country at the time. I'm not so sure that polling numbers, in the 1950s, for example, he ran for office, you know, and his party received about 10% of the vote. Back then, Sihanouk and La Nol were allies. The problem with interpreting election results in a place like Cambodia in the 50s and 60s is that you have a communist movement that refused to divulge what their agenda actually was. Back then, Sihanouk said, this party will be socialist for the well-being of the people, royalist for the prestige and cohesion of the nation. So back then, this is a very healthy approach to things. Had La Nol been able to develop the country with that kind of ideology, it would be a very, very different story in Southeast Asia today. Sihanouk, his removal from power was absolutely inevitable. The movement to overthrow him had very conservative royalist elements, like Nol himself, and had more Jacobin elements who wanted a more liberal system. But in the midst of civil war and foreign invasion, you know, liberalism doesn't make any sense. It's almost ridiculous. That can only exist once society is stable. And of course, it makes sure that society is stable for long. La Nol's Minister of Information, Chang Song, said essentially it was a silent invasion of Vietnamese into Cambodia. They didn't want to overthrow Sihanouk, but he was a weak man. He wanted to be popular. He may have been ignorant in certain areas. And yet his prestige was such that he helped create the communist movement there. Once the U.S. pulls out of Vietnam, the anti-communist movement in Cambodia is in a lot of trouble. The Vietnamese now have won a victory. They've blockaded all supplies coming in and out of the country. They were well organized. They were now battle hardened. They attacked communications, all kinds of shipping. Terrorism, as always, was a normal way of life for them. They killed civilians at the village level all the time. That was an actual specific part of Viet Cong agenda. And they even had quotas, as I've dealt with elsewhere, killing, you know, high-ranking civilians in the local level was absolutely essential. once the Khmer Republic falls in 1975, of course, Lon Nol was number one to be executed. So he fled the country. The Khmer Rouge always claimed that it was in favor of a self-sufficient Cambodia, which is okay when you understand the tremendous confusion of all this foreign influence. But Cambodia is relatively small. Pol Pot controlled the media once he took over. But prior to this, you know, he ran much of the countryside even before he took over in 1975. So they already had a pretty experienced cadre in terms of running the country. They had their own press. They had their confession sessions. If any of you have seen The Killing Fields, you know what I'm talking about. But Lon Nol understood that either it was going to be a massive bloodbath like you had in China, or him. There was no third option, and that is absolutely certainly the case. The communists usually win by superior propaganda, lying about their agenda, and in this case, the Khmer Rouge was talking about, just like, you know, the Soviets did, you know, prior to the 1921. They said, you know, there's going to be free land, there's going to be peace, you know, the ancient tradition is going to be restored, all this. They didn't believe any of this. Lon Nol fled the country a broken man. He was not a bad man. He, under normal circumstances, would have probably been an efficient leader. So much of the Khmer Rouge system was being supported initially by Vietnam as well as China, and most of their army was being replenished by impressment. They were forcing young peasant kids into the army. Their army went from 3,000 to 40,000 in that period of time in the early 70s. 1973, I mean, the system didn't fall until 1975, and Pol Pot took over. 1973, 90% of Cambodia was in the hands of Pol Pot. But the Vietnamese army had much to do with these victories, far more so than the Khmer Rouge itself. There's a scholar named Rakauer who wrote an interesting article on the Khmer Rouge. He's an academic, so, you know, it's mostly crap. But he says this. He's talking about the Khmer Rouge just before they took over in 75. Revolution and the existence of a revolutionary party were not only played down in their propaganda. They were completely hidden truths revealed only to the enlightened few who could achieve senior positions in the apparatus. He means the Khmer Rouge. Revolution was not an asset, but an ultimate goal, which had to be achieved by devious and clandestine means, since even the beneficiaries could not be led towards paradise. And that's essential. It was an extreme case in Cambodia, but you see it throughout the communist world. He continues. He says, having learned in the past that peasants didn't really understand such concepts as feudalism and capitalism, the Khmer Rouge launched a grassroots campaign with a simple message: greater material wealth and a higher standard of living. Members moved into the countryside. They dressed like commoners. They assisted village folk wherever they could. They built trust by building homes and roads and all this. They built a mass loyal following, totally unaware of the party's master plan. Members joined either because they were well-educated students, disillusioned with the current state of government, or more often, citizens resentful of Sihanouk's ouster and the ensuing devastation of the country at the hands of outside forces. Now, so this has been established even by academics in the liberal universities that, you know, the Khmer Rouge simply lied about who they were. When Mao Zedong referred to the people, he says this actually over and over again in the Little Red Book, when he refers to the people or the masses, that's the technical term. He doesn't mean everybody. Mao makes it very clear that there are the masses and then there are his enemies. They're the people, and they're his enemies. His enemies aren't people. So when they use that phrase, whether it be workers, masses, people, they're not referring to just the abstract citizen. They're referring to party cadres only. Up until the start of the Civil War, smallholding was the norm in Cambodia. It was a just society. Once the Khmer Rouge takes over in 1975, one of the first things they did, and it was very stupid, was to drive the Vietnamese and the Chinese out of the country, now that they weren't needed anymore. And this began the massive purges, the so-called Great Leap Forward. What Mao and Pol Pot believed, and this is almost a religious element here. This isn't even in Marxism. This is almost a religious element of their thinking that somehow, through this massive cataclysm of violence and bloodshed, the communist utopia could be brought about in a short period of time. 1 or 2 years. That explains the extreme levels of bloodshed in both China and Cambodia. But 1974, what had been a relatively prosperous smallholder economy was near famine conditions. In the 1950s and 60s, the percentage of landless peasants went from 4% to 20%, which is an anomaly. But the fact you only had 4% of the peasants who were landless says something about the nature of the society. So what some people have called the super great leap forward into socialism was based on lying about this fact and saying, no, the landlords controlled everything. When in fact, very much like in Russia in 1900, the landlords were, of course, the peasants themselves. They were to create the purest, most fair society ever known in our history, which is one of their statements. The Great Leap Forward in Mao Zedong's thinking was a radical and extremely violent cleansing of all feudal and traditional elements, idea, people, perceived classes. They actually, Chandler and some other scholars say that Pol Pot thought that he could bring about socialism in a month. And this created this urgency that utopia is right around the corner, and it became this almost religious element of thinking, or I should say mystic, I should say mystic element of thinking that if we just get rid of foreigners, not because they're foreigners, but because, you know, they're not members of the party and we don't need them anymore, and we need to go to the people and say that we're purely in favor of Khmer nationalism. But the real reason, of course, was that they can blame them for all the problems. And this kind of extreme violence really came at a high price. So much of their administration was damaged because of this. And so they're always compensating for it. But with the defeat of Lon Nol, you didn't have, and with the U.S. nowhere to be found, you didn't have an armed, strong organization strong enough to fight the communists, who were being supported by both Vietnam and, actually Vietnam, China, and the Soviet Union in different eras. Remember what collectivization is. You read about it in the Soviet context. You read about it. It's a little different in the Chinese and the Cambodian context because, as I said, the traditional ties of Cambodian society had been destroyed, far more so than in China. So even Cambodia is an extreme version of that. Families had been destroyed. Villages had been destroyed. The ties from man to man and class to class had been destroyed. So when they created these forcible collectives in the countryside, they were strangers to one another. They were deeply alienated, resentful strangers. Slowly the state, of course, took all land and all implements, which, by the way, the peasants used to own, and then grant them a ration of food relative to their work. And that ration got lower and lower as time went on. Hinton, another writer, a hit or miss writer on the topic, he talks about collectivization and undermining the three key features of traditional peasant life. He says, first, the family, whose members jointly engage in economic production and consumption. The village, which was composed of friends and relatives who shared a sense of identity and sometimes assisted one another. And Buddhism, which provided a social, moral, and educational locus for everyday life. In the new society, Buddhism was banned, and the means and relations of production communized. Cambodians were soon working and eating in collectives that provided a large labor pool needed to accomplish the key economic goal of the new regime. And that was drastically increasing rice production. Now, the reason, of course, Mao wanted to do that was rice was being traded for guns from China. So the alienation of the common peasantry was extremely important. You couldn't have gotten away with this elsewhere. So war, foreign occupation, skillful propaganda, the bombing both of the U.S. and the Vietnamese due to the Vietnamese invasion of Cambodia, the silent invasion under Prince Sihanouk, created this tremendous anxiety. This is what constant warfare does. Historians have a tendency to underplay this. You had this in Afghanistan from the 70s onward. What does constant warfare and constant disruption and constant fear do to a population collectively? No one asked that question. And this is why liberalism is so ridiculous in these societies. So now that the village was destroyed, ANCAR, or the organization, this organization of power that's going to bring peace and prosperity to everybody, in a period of time where people were highly suggestive or suggestible, took over, and this is the reason why the bloodletting was so severe. Pol Pot says this. He says, one of the important factors for Cambodia's success after April of 1975 was the evacuation of city residents to the countryside. This was decided before victory was won, that is, in February of 75, because we knew that before the smashing of all sorts of enemy spy organizations, our strength was not strong enough to defend the revolutionary regime. Judging from the struggles waged from 1976 to 1977, the enemy's secret agent network lying low in our country was very massive and complicated. But when we crushed them, it was difficult for them to stage a comeback. Their forces are scattered in the various cooperatives that are now in our grip. That's Pol Pot's comment. And it's really, there's a lot to untangle there. No one has done it, so I guess I have to do it. Cities were depopulated. Partially it was because, during the war, the only people who did well in these cities were rentiers or usurers. That's probably true. Warfare has a tendency to do that. That foreigners dominated in the cities. A lot of strong, nationalist movements. I'm not talking about Cambodia here necessarily, but have a strong countryside, very weak urban presence. Vietnamese and Chinese tended to dominate in the cities. He admits that the Khmer Rouge wasn't strong enough to defend the system, his own system that he had just taken over, because this spy network was so overwhelming. So he's constantly keeping people in a state of agitation. Trotsky did the exact same thing. This is what permanent revolution means in a few different ways. But even when they smashed it, Pol Pot says, even when I smashed their organization, they're still there. And then he goes so far as to say, yeah, we've destroyed them, but not really destroyed them, because now they're in our agricultural cooperatives. So the revolution wasn't even a revolution in his mind. He had this, and it's paranoia in the true, actual sense of the word, not the popular sense of the term, where using this concept of a spy network took on a life of its own. The notion of the confession, the cleansing sessions of a village, everyone would get together and they would confess their sins to each other. You know, I took more than my ration share. I said something against ANCAR. I thought about my mother. Of course, the family was banned entirely. I felt love towards my father. These were all things they had to confess, especially little kids. The family was proscribed as an institution. And not just because it had been damaged badly by the war, but it hadn't been destroyed by the war. They created, of course, as is often the case in revolutionary societies, a new calendar. 1975 was year zero. Because everything prior to 1975 didn't matter. It was going to be wiped out. He created a 10-day week and one day of that 10 was a day of rest, which of course never happened. Remember, Pol Pot controlled much of the countryside even before he took over in 75. And that's where he began to perfect the notion of this Soviet-style collective, where all capital is controlled by Angkor, or the organization. And one of the reasons you didn't have strong rebellion against them was because so much of the traditional ties had been broken. It's significant that meals were taken in common. And I said the family was banned. They're not kidding around. It was. Meals are the time where a family gets together with the father as the head of the family, and they discuss business, they discuss one another. You know, it's actually a ritual, it's a very important ritual. It exists in all traditional societies. Even this now has been destroyed. Even the preparation of food is done by the state. Someone who, Thong Cheng, who fled the Pol Pot regime in 1977, he said this. From January of 77, all children over about 8 years of age, including people of my age, he was 20, were separated from their parents, whom we were no longer allowed to see, although we remained in the village. We were divided into groups consisting of young men, young women, and young children, each group normally about 300 strong. The food was normally rice and salt, was pooled and served communally. Also in early 77, collective marriages involving hundreds of mostly unwilling couples took place for the first time. All personal property was confiscated. A new round of executions began, more wide-ranging than that of 1975, and involving anyone who could not or would not carry out their work duties. Food rations were cut significantly, leading to more deaths from starvation, as were clothing allowances. Three sets of clothes per year was now the rule. Groups of more than two people were forbidden to assemble. Part of the problem was that in the banning of the family, he also banned money. Now you could see that there may be, you know, there's a good motivation behind it. But, and money was worthless at the time because inflation had gotten so bad by the time he took over in 75, banning money was almost, you know, irrelevant. So rice became the medium of exchange. They measured it out in tins of rice, but they bartered anything. Foreign trade collapsed entirely. Rice was shipped to China in exchange for guns, and that was pretty much the only foreign trade that existed. Note that no one in the West was told of this. There were plenty of journalists out there who wrote back saying everything's fine. No sanctions were put on this country, despite this being known. And this is where Noam Chomsky made a jerk of himself, because he said, we can't trust any of these refugees, because they're probably lying. You know, refugees from the concentration camps in Germany should be, you know, believed without fail. But when they criticize a communist society, they have to be rejected. Noam Chomsky denied a lot of this only later on, having to admit that it's the case. Only under this condition, then, Pol Pot said, we are now free from foreign control, which, by the way, was another lie, because they were still highly dependent on Chinese weaponry and Chinese assistance. In 1976, the New York Times said that mass slaughters in Cambodia were a myth. The article was April 6, 1976. April 1st of that year, they had a headline, Cambodia increases rations, suggesting prosperity. On March 7th, 76, the New York Times said the U.S. is carpet bombing the country to destroy communism there. Of course, it was a myth that that was not happening. The Vietnamese were involved because the Vietnamese were being thrown out of the country. You had a full genocide denial among the far left in America starting in 1976-77. Chomsky said this is tall tales that are being told here. Unfortunately, he was aware of Pol Pot's agenda, that this was something that wasn't, it was not an anomaly in the system. As I've said before, this is, it's a part of the system. It's inherent to the system that violence and cleansing be done. So there's no way not to know. But this notion of self, self-condemnation, the idea of self-criticism, I should call it. The family's destroyed and banned. The village is destroyed. They're being herded into these collectives of groups of strangers. It was only Ankar that gave them any answers. Because they wanted this crash collectivization to be done only in a short period of time, they had to make sure that even the very thought process of the people were being watched. That's where these confession sessions every night took place. The Deputy Prime Minister, Yingsari, at the time, says this. The Communist Party of Kampuchea uses criticism and self-criticism as daily means to struggle to build up its internal forces, the party. Criticism and self-criticism refers to learning to make lifestyle criticism and to assess political strengths and shortcomings. In every meeting, we single out advantages and disadvantages and find the correct solutions. This is what we call criticism. If you keep doing constructive internal criticism to the political consciousness, organizational standpoints of the party, and bring the masses in line with the consciousness of the organization, our enemies cannot undermine us. This became a far more extreme version of the Chinese version of the same idea. And he wasn't, you know, he wasn't shy about saying, this is how we're going to root out any kind of treason. And it created intense psychological pressure. Second in command under Pol Pot, Nguyen Che, brother number two, says this. He says, in Phnom Penh, the capital, criticism and self-criticism sessions were held every week for various cadres, soldiers, workers, and leaders who lived there. And this was meant to be universal. Officials were warned about the pests buried within. In our country, 1 to 5% of the population are traitors who are infiltrating, so we must investigate their biographies clearly and have them self-criticize. And of course, what he means is that eventually, through this confession, which they had to do every night in public, every village, every organization, they'd eventually find out who the weak links are and get rid of them. So no more does Noam Chomsky and others try to deny the genocide of the society. Instead, what they do now is attempt to blame the U.S. somehow because of the bombing campaign. They claim this isn't really Marxism, which is their famous standby, which is laughable. You know, well, if that's not really Marxism, this isn't really capitalism. And it's a dishonest argument. The Khmer Rouge came to power through Chinese and Vietnamese support and because of a very ignorant prince who thought that he could be popular and have a foot in both camps, and it failed. He honestly thought that the communists could compromise. And of course, Pol Pot may have worked with the prince for a while. He knew it was only a matter of time before the prince lost his head. Only General Lan Nol knew this. Now, during these confession sessions, the notion was developed that enemies come in some categories. Of course, people connected with the old government, with Lan Nol, or any foreign government other than China, were completely eliminated, especially if they were connected to the Vietnamese. And the whole notion of the intellectual, an intellectual was a term of abuse in Cambodia. Kind of like when we say the word journalist, meaning our embedded prostitutes. That's kind of what they meant by the word intellectual. These are people who couldn't create anything, so they go wherever the money is. Now, Pol Pot himself was, you know, he knew French. He was educated in France. He did drop out of school, but he was an educated man. Ankar had all of the answers. Of course, the Roman Catholics were wiped out. The Buddhist monasteries were completely uprooted and all of their land confiscated. And It is true that racial and ethnic minorities were completely destroyed, but that wasn't because of some kind of nationalism. They were avowedly internationalist, except it was very convenient to blame them for it. So needless to say, the economy collapsed entirely. It was already on the verge of collapsing in 1975. It almost went to non-existence by the time that the Vietnamese invaded the country officially and overthrew Pol Pot in 79. There were substantial border conflicts between the two nations that go back a long time. There was a colonial era border, both maritime and physical, that was always under dispute, and negotiations collapsed. What Pol Pot was doing was lowering rations to starvation levels, but now using a threat from Vietnam and this terror network thing that he talked about in almost every speech to rally the population. The Cambodian army began attacking villages in Thai border areas as well as Vietnamese border areas, and they were engaging in atrocities on purpose. Vietnamese villages were not spared. The airstrikes that the left was trying to blame on the U.S. were a Vietnamese response to the Khmer Rouge attack on their territory. They blamed this on the U.S., and given the fact that the media didn't really exist, it was believed. The Bao Chuc massacre took place in April 1978. Where the Cambodian unit invaded Vietnam and killed precisely 3,157 civilians. And border fighting, right up until the very end, killed about, well, actually really say in this small period of time we're talking about here, April of 78, about 1,000 Vietnamese civilian casualties were reported. So in the summer, the Vietnamese counterattacked with a force of about 20,000 men. But this wasn't sufficient. He didn't realize that Pol Pot was throwing everything into this. Pol Pot assumed that the Chinese would come to his assistance, both economically and militarily, so it really didn't matter what he did. He was reckless, and he was stupid. He was taking a gigantic risk with the idea that the Chinese would always have his back. So about 60,000 reinforcements were sent, the invasion force, into Cambodia, by the end of the year. Now, the next year, the Vietnamese pulled out, thinking that they had, they taught them a lesson, we can get out of here. They had their own problems to worry about. But the Cambodians were aware that their force was in no condition, with starvation rations, to fight a very large, battle-hardened, and highly motivated Vietnamese army. The Vietnamese did try to maintain some kind of peaceful coexistence. But there was a radio broadcast in 1978, Radio Phnom Penh, declared that if each Cambodian soldier in our army killed 30 Vietnamese people, then it would only take 2 million men to slaughter the entire population of Vietnam, which was 50 million people. Now, this was official. This was official policy. This came right up in state radio. They had this all figured out. So each soldier has to kill 30 Vietnamese. We could wipe out the entire country. There was a break with reality here that occurred in Pol Pot and his leadership. Because, of course, the Vietnamese knew about this. And the only thing that makes any sense here is that they were trying to provoke a Chinese invasion of Vietnam. And it just so happens, although they would deny this, and the left denies this to this day, Vietnamese troops were welcomed with sugarcane and water, which was their greeting, like you had in Ukraine, the Germans. They were not invaders. They were never seen as invaders. Cambodia had created maybe its own economic category, maybe fifth world. And since there was no money, there's really no way to know. Subsistence farming was non-existent. Malnutrition was almost universal. There was no substantial education system. There was no market. There was only a small amount of safe drinking water. There was no sanitation. There was no way to pay anybody. There was no way to connect work with reward. So using this Vietnamese threat that they were going to provoke, hoping for a Chinese response, was the only way out. Again, throughout this period of time, there was no condemnation from the West. There was no sanctions or anything like that. They'll do that for Putin, though, and the Iranians, but they won't do that for this in Cambodia. There were a few attempts, coup attempts. Vuong Vitt was one. The deputy prime minister tried to overthrow him. He was executed in the S-21 camp in 1978. And the invasion finally took place at the end of the year, December 22nd. And finally, a force of 120,000 drove into the countryside and took the capital. And it took only 17 days for Phnom Penh to fall, January 7th, 1979. And of course, their own reports of mass malnutrition, including in the army, again, is one of the reasons that the Vietnamese had no problem destroying them. What you had at the time was a complete, almost a non-existent, it was a society almost down back to the state of nature in a certain way. The Vietnamese uncovered, of course, was the killing field, which now, given this circumstance, we now understand. It not only occurred and occurred with great violence, but was built into the system itself. The very fact that Radio Phnom Penh can say that, all right, we figured out that one Cambodian soldier, if one Cambodian soldier kills 30 Vietnamese, we could wipe out the entire population in a short period of time. You know, we just need 2 million troops and we can eliminate, you know, the entire population. But there was a sense in Pol Pot that he had lost any sense of reality. He began believing his own notion that this was utopia that was just over the border if he was able to destroy the spy networks that were everywhere, including in his own party, to the point where everybody had to confess their biography, what they did that day. Everybody had to do this just in case it would be some contradiction that could be punished and this person eliminated or corrected. The Chinese Greatly Forward was similar to this, but not as severe. The abolition of money, the destruction of the Buddhist monasteries, which meant, and the monasteries aren't, they're not monasteries in the Christian sense, these are schools. These were absolute, central, critical centers of science and literature, and really, how society was governed. That was all destroyed. There was nothing left. So for the left to believe that it was the American bombing that brought the Khmer Rouge to power, it's just they're trying to soothe their own conscience. That is not what brought them to power. Because the minute Pol Pot took over, he completely destroyed what had only been tottering by 1975. The economy never recovered. His solution to runaway inflation is to ban money. So there's no way, there's no economic statistics at the time. No one has any idea what was being produced. There is no official statistics, and the closest you can get is some rice being sent to China in exchange for weapons. And the Chinese were using Cambodia for what it could be used for, but I don't believe that China believed that this country could last. When the Vietnamese finally took the capital, after only a 17-day campaign, they found a population and an army that was very weak, that was extremely alienated. And when you have starvation, when you have a lack of sleep, when you have the psychological pressure of having to confess everything you do every day, every night to the community, strangers, by the way, knowing full well that this could lead to your death, what personality does that create? What kind of pressure is each individual under? There's no analog to this. For the historian, there's no way to compare this to anybody. So it's bad enough that you have this confusion and chaos. It's bad enough that you have no functional economy, that they're starving, they're not sleeping. But the psychological pressure of having to stand up in front of a group of people, like it's Alcoholics Anonymous, and saying what you did that might be considered slightly against party regulations every single night. So there's absolutely no privacy at all. There's no private thoughts. There's no private nothing. And you were questioned when you got up there. Now, everyone didn't have to say something every night. It was staggered. But there were ways to discover who was hiding something. If someone wasn't talking, they would be eventually called on. It's so easy to forget the psychological pressure that drives this period of history. The absolute alienation, the hopelessness, and then you add starvation, you add absolute total uncertainty, pure chaos. You have a people who are very suggestible. They began to believe what Pol Pot said, but once the Vietnamese invaded, they had no will to resist. General Lan Nol was the last chance that Cambodia had to create a rational society. He is a traditionalist royalist who had the best of intentions, but he didn't have, he came to power in 1970 just as the U.S. is winding down its presence in the area. There was no other way for him to get the weaponry. There was some trade with Thailand, but remember something. Thailand was engaged in substantial timber deals with the Khmer Rouge, and they've been back and forth for a long time, even in the 50s. Even after Pol Pot was overthrown, these guys only died recently. When Pol Pot was overthrown, that's where he lived. He went to Thailand. The timber concession was so lucrative that Thailand was not going to mess with the Khmer Rouge on that ground. This was not, had nothing to do with the economy. This was a personal investment. And of course, they used the Thai baht as their currency. But because of that, Thailand was not going to be an ally of the anti-communists there. Even though they were an ally to the U.S. in Vietnam, where they had a substantial army assisting the Americans and the South Vietnamese and the South Koreans. The communists, as always, had superior organization, had tremendous money, and because these people were excellent at lying about their intentions, they essentially said that there were this, conservative populist agrarian movement. But by the time they took over, things had descended to such chaos, there was no way to fight back. This is Maoist socialism. This is Leninism. In the Asian variety. It's not an anomaly. This is what the system is. It's built into the regime. Stalin would have loved to have done this. Trotsky would have loved to have done this. But the chaos in Russia at the time is nowhere near what Cambodia had been put through. And remember, it's just been a colony. It was newly independent. Constant warfare. The chaos is almost unthinkable. Almost no traditional institution remained. Lan Nol was the last chance. And to this day, academics and journalists will defend the Khmer Rouge, at least by saying that it's the Americans' fault. We had nothing to do with it. They were nationalists and racists and Buddhists. I could show you all the comments and all the quotations where they say this nonsense. The only reason they say it is to soothe their own conscience. Noam Chomsky is one of these people. He knows he did the wrong thing. He knows he defended these monsters. And he will tell you that the Americans brought them the power, the CIA brought them the power, which is utter nonsense. The Chinese, early on, the Vietnamese, the Soviet money, Chinese money, built the Communist Party through Prince Sihanouk, of all people, the monarch, And that's one of the things that made this an anomalous situation, is that the monarch was backing the communists, which is such a weird circumstance. The collapse occurred before the Khmer Rouge took over. The Khmer Rouge just brought it to chaos, under the belief that once they're pushed to the utter brink, total, you know, you can't get any lower, Angkor could bring them the salvation. It was a mystic understanding. That is the legacy of Maoism and Leninism in Asia. On a college campus, if you claim to be a Maoist, no problem. No problem. Never any sanctions on these countries. Supporting, you know, nationalism or national socialism, you're a monster. Supporting Mao, no problem at all. It's a mainstream position in academia. And they're defending him to this day. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Orthodox Nationalists with Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson at RadioArian.com.